Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:01 PM, that is Pacific Standard Time. Today is February 1st. Well, the one thing I think we should always remember is that capital is both global and mobile. So when China was tightening on the LIBOR front, and we're looking at the overnight rate for SHIBOR, which is the Shanghai interbank rate, it popped from 50 basis points to 300 basis points in January alone. And that had a knock-on effect for some appetite for risk in the stock market. Also, there was this increasing risk of tightness in the corporate sector. So they were experiencing some, although probably on a lesser degree, of the risks that the Fed had experienced a couple of years ago when they tightened up with quantitative tightening and then had this knock-on effect in the repo market. So today we saw that China started to ease back and SHIBOR started to come back down. It was down pretty meaningfully, approximately 35 basis points, which is the biggest decline we've seen in months. So that's certainly positive. But what it also helps to highlight is that China's SHIBOR rate came down and stock markets basically jumped. So that's the global part of monetary policy. The reality today is that the two big central banks in the world are the Federal Reserve and the People's Bank of China, with the ECB coming up third, for the simple reason that the ECB is less activist. Even though they've got negative interest rates and have been more extreme in the range of solutions they're willing to prefer, the size of the interventions that the ECB has been engaged in hasn't been as large as either in China or in the USA. So capital is both global and mobile. When it becomes more available in one of the big countries with the most activist central banks, it has a knock-on effect everywhere. And the Nasdaq in particular rallied back really quite firmly in here today. So that is now continuing to hold the sequence of higher reaction lows. And we've also started to see that the S&P 500 rebounded. So it had broken its sequence of higher reaction lows. And now the question is, will we see upside follow through tomorrow? A lot of what happens will probably depend on the VIX index. The VIX popped on the upside on Wednesday of last week, and that coincided with the big move in GameStop, but it is now coming back down again, and it was down 3 points in here today. One thing that, if we're going to look at peaks in the VIX and then correlate those with the kind of activity we've had in the stock market, well, each time it has popped up to 40 has been a buying opportunity. So if we go back and think about the fact that the last one was in early November, then the next before that was in early September. So if we then look back at what those periods meant, in early November it was a buying opportunity, in the middle of September it was the same thing. And we've seen a modest pullback for the index on this occasion, but a more and a similar move on the VIX to what we saw back on those two occasions. So this might have been the dip that people were looking for, myself included. But we are not out of the woods just yet, and we haven't had a particularly big move anyway. But of course, the other side of this is that bond yields are continuing to hold below the 1.2% level. And it's quite clear to anyone who just simply looks at the numbers that the Federal Reserve can't tolerate a yield above 2%. And that really is the terminal value. The last thing they want is for it to push through the 1.2% level, because that would establish a trend. And trends are more difficult to combat than isolated instances of strength. So Treasury yields were in negative territory additionally in here. Now, I've posted a number of videos from the Double Line Roundtable with some investment luminaries over which has been posted over the course of January. There's a lot of fear being expressed by these people, and of course the majority have a fixed income bias, which really focuses people more on the negative outcome than the positive outcome. But the one thing that I thought was particularly interesting is that as people are worried about valuations, and there is, I think, a reason to be worried about valuations, because when we think about the number of zombie companies, then we're at an historic high. But what we can also think about is that on an historic basis, the number of times when we do get elevated numbers of zombie companies, it coincides with bubbly periods. Now, we can also think about the fact that we've had a lot of these types of companies surviving during the period after the financial crisis, for the simple reason that we've had a low interest rate environment for a very prolonged period of time. We've had abundant credit, and that has allowed companies that wouldn't normally be able to fund themselves at accommodative levels to do just that. But of course, after the pandemic, we've obviously had a lot of companies that have been in dire straits. Now the question, of course, is how willing will lenders be to continue to fund these types of companies? And of course, a lot of it will have to do with the broader interest rate environment and monetary policy overall. Well, monetary policy remains accommodative. Last week we saw, for example, that Jay Powell knocked on the head any real talk of tapering, with the Chinese now moving to make money available to the banking sector through the SHIBOR rate. That's also a positive. When we think about Europe, then they are still rather actively trying to devalue the euro. And I guess they have had at least some success in talking it down, that the euro was in negative territory in here today. So we're seeing an unwinding of this overbought condition by the euro, but then it's likely that, well, I think it's very unlikely that the euro's uptrend is in fact over, because the USA is doing more than anyone else to devalue their currency. One thing that we've seen over the course of the last 3 days have been pops in the silver price, and none of them have held the advance. But it was up 10% in here today nonetheless. Now, it tested the $30 level and briefly moved to a new high. And if it can sustain a move above $30, well, then it will have concluded the five-month consolidation, which, for all intents and purposes, looks like a first step above the base. Now, when we look at the chart, then we have a very clearly defined range and base formation. We have the failed downside break in 2020, then the clear breakout in 2020 as well, a rather volatile range over the course of the last 5 months, and we're just beginning to push up and out of that. We might yet see consolidation in the region of the peak. And then, of course, we don't have quite the same cohesion from the Reddit traders in silver as we did in GameStop, because some of them are, at least are worried that by promoting silver, they're also aiding institutional investors, and that narrative of David versus Goliath doesn't quite play out. Of course, the irony is that there has been a David and Goliath story between the precious metal investors generally, whether institutional or retail, versus the central banks and their inflationary policies for years, if not generations. And that is the basis upon which any secular bull market in precious metals is based, because what we are looking at on an international stage today is competitive currency devaluation. There is no country wants a strong currency. And when we think about what the ECB is doing to try and curtail the strength of the euro, and the fact that the Chinese have now moved to aid the banking sector with the cut to SHIBOR, well, then that is also weakening the renminbi. So there's still potential that we're going to see additional strength in the dollar in here, just because it's not quite the most active central bank in the world at the present time, even though that mantle certainly isn't in question over the medium term. Gold prices were pretty stable in here today, up a bit, but not in an especially dynamic manner. I continue to think that platinum is its upside potential is underappreciated. There is the clear scope that it is going to significantly outperform palladium over the course of the next few months. Palladium was barely steady today in the region of the trend mean. I think the balance of probabilities is that it is going to break on the downside, and that there is a clear incentive by institutional traders or futures traders to play that ratio between platinum and palladium. One is iconic in terms of the internal combustion engine, whereas platinum can be cast as the renewable energies metal because of its role in the hydrogen fuel cell market. And of course, that is still virgin territory overall. Now, when we then think about what else is going on in the world, well, obviously, we have this concern about the impact of these speculative moves, and that is representative of a lot of money sloshing around. But does anybody really think that we're coming to the end of that money sloshing around? One of the, I think, important points that Ed Hyman was making was that at the bubble peaks in 1929, in 2000, and in 1989 in Japan, the PE ratio was at 30, and the bond yield was at 5%. Well, arguably, we're in a completely different situation this time because the quantity of money that is being printed is literally off the charts. When there is 17, or I guess it's probably not quite that high, but at least $16 billion with negative yielding, 16.8 billion with negative yields out there, then when we're talking about billions, it just sounds like funny money. So the question, of course, then is whether yields really do need to get to 5% in order to pop a bubble. But the one thing that we would have to see is at least one interest rate hike, and we're still a long way away from that. And in the intervening period, there is ample scope for further upside. The one thing we see after every crash is that the PE ratio gets up to extraordinary levels because earnings fall and don't recover as quick as prices. So in the immediate aftermath of a crash, you get high PEs. Then the economy recovers and you start to see those PEs moderate. So then, of course, the big question for investors and everyone else is going to be how quickly will the GDP and normal economic activity recover after the pandemic? And of course, that does bring us to the question of vaccinations. And there is a sizable population of people in most countries who will not take a vaccine under any circumstances. In Israel, that's the Orthodox and the domestic Arab population. In the USA, it is the anti-vax community, and then a sizable proportion of the black community will not take a vaccine because they simply do not trust the government, don't trust the medical profession, and that is obviously an inhibiting factor to easily getting to herd immunity. What it really means is that research into developing treatments to the coronavirus is equally important to the production of vaccines, because people will continue to be getting sick, particularly those that refuse to get vaccinated. Of course, how much that means in terms of the economic potential of the global economy is an entirely different story entirely. We know that some people, particularly those that are most susceptible or that experience very severe symptoms, are most likely to have knock-on long COVID type symptoms. But The reality is everybody I know who's had it has recovered and had no problems. And then I also know a number of people who've had the vaccine and have experienced no side effects either, or at least not more side effects than one would anticipate from, say, the Hep B vaccine, or any other of the kinds of vaccines you get when you're going abroad. So the reality is that at least in the short term, the effects are manageable. Quite what the long-term effects are, of course, remains to be seen. But one thing that should be comforting, at least to some people, will be that they were attempting to pioneer these types of genetic vaccines to counter Ebola, and then Ebola just disappeared, so they didn't get a chance to do it. But they did do all the safety protocols before, in fact, launching those products. So they are reasonably sure that these vaccines are safe, and a lot of people in the biotechnology sector, and I've listened to a number of conference calls and earnings reports, have said that they would get it. So I think if people in the biotechnology sector who know more about it than I do are willing to get a vaccine, then I probably will as well. And I think most people who get the flu vaccine annually are probably not going to have much of an issue with getting a vaccine, another vaccine. Of course, then of course we have the fact that there are an increasingly large number of vaccines that are going to be approved. Vaccines have been the number one thing that politicians have said they need before they're willing to open up. And I think they're going to stay true to their word. So as long as vaccines are rolled out and the number of people being vaccinated increases, then the likelihood is that they will open up the economies, and there is a lot of pent-up demand. In those videos from Double Line, I did see that one point that David Rosenberg was making was that there isn't any pent-up demand, in, or there isn't the same amount of pent-up demand for eating out at restaurants and travel that there is for that's or it's not going to be enough to compensate for the massive demand and spending that we've seen in the last 12 months for staple goods and longer-term purchases like home equipment. But the other point is that the people who do eat out at restaurants and travel a lot are the higher income people generally. And one of the biggest spending items annually for the higher income bracket is travel and leisure. So that does represent a very substantial ongoing additional source of spending in the economy. Whereas, yes, the expenditure we've seen on staples is not going to be repeated in 2021, or at least is unlikely to be. Meanwhile, the continued speculative interest in assets is likely to continue to be spurred by abundant liquidity. Then we can think about the fact that as long as we have the potential for central banks to continue to support these asset price appreciation trends, then it's likely to continue. It's really only when we start to see significant efforts to try and normalize policy that we're going to have a clear change. I did say last week that we need to watch China because they are the first to try and tighten. Well, what we saw today was that they haven't been particularly successful. And they've had their own little mini version of the taper tantrum. So now the question, of course, is how much easier is policy going to get in China? And of course, that will have a knock-on effect for the global economy as well. As we look at the commodity sector, then the continuous. Oh, that's really rather odd. We haven't. I was not aware that the CCI index has now been restricted. That's something that I wasn't anticipating. It's been public information since the early 1970s. So obviously the fact that someone has taken it over, well, that's really rather unfortunate because the CRB, which is what we're looking at right now, is much heavier weighted by oil. But oil prices do continue to march higher. Oil is the most important commodity in the world because every country uses it, a fraction of those countries produce it, and it is integral to the production of just about every other commodity as well. And oil prices were up in a meaningful manner in here today, almost a full dollar to push right back up to the upper side of the range. And that's also a vote of confidence in additional upside. With colder weather coming through in the USA, natural gas has also rebounded in a pretty emphatic fashion from the region of the trend mean, and it has now broken the sequence of lower rally highs. So there is still clear scope that we're going to see a further rally in natural gas prices. As we look around the world, the strengthening dollar is potentially a headwind for emerging markets, but emerging markets also took their cue from easier policy in China today. So the Nifty index was up in a dynamic manner. I did also produce this chart, and I'm posting it in comment of the day today. It clearly highlights that when the median age goes over about 40, for developed economies, they're much more likely to have extremely low interest rates, whether that is for the UK or Taiwan, or for France, Switzerland, the EU, or Germany, or the EU generally, of course, which is a euphemism for Germany. They all have negative yields. But then, as we see, for example, that Israel has a somewhat younger demographic, but its yield is also lower. So that's idiosyncrasies. Certainly, Israel is a highly developed economy. When we then look at the other idiosyncrasies out there, like South Korea has quite a high yield and also has a high population median age. Well, that's something it shares with Hong Kong, but of course there are idiosyncratic risks that one has to appreciate when investing in either of those countries. The Philippines is another idiosyncrasy. It's got a high yield and a young population, but not nearly as high as some other countries. But the broad picture here is of you get young people, high yields, old people, low yields. This was a point that Jim Bianco made a few years ago, so I've tried to update the chart with the yields as they stand today. It's the primary argument for really betting that yields are not going to rise. Well, the USA is a little different because it is younger overall than a number of the countries that have got very low interest rates. So, interestingly, it's the same with New Zealand. It's got almost the same median age and the same yields overall. The immigration question in the USA is extremely political and highly emotive, but one factor is that with young people moving into the country, it does help to keep the median age down and is probably a factor in ensuring that interest rates, or at least yields, stay positive in the USA for the foreseeable future. Of course, that is obviously going to have a bearing on the risk-free rate, on how people value the market. Of course, there's nobody, when we think about the upside potential for yields, I don't think there's anybody wants to think about the 10-year yield getting to 2%. Well, when we start to think about what that means, well, it really suggests that the Federal Reserve is going to be trying to control the yield curve. It's absolutely inevitable. The higher the yield goes, the more likely they are to intervene. One thing we also saw in here today is that the yield curve is continuing to hold below the 100 basis point level, but it was higher. So, with the yield curve continuing to push higher, the Federal Reserve is unlikely to do anything to curtail it until they have evidence of a knock-on effect for asset prices. Once they have evidence of a knock-on effect, that's when we'll see the next big round of quantitative easing, and it will likely coincide with the next big down leg in the dollar. I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.